Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Nicole Holofcener is a writer and a director. She has made some truly brilliant films. She also comes from a show business family. Her mom was an Academy Award-winning set decorator. Her stepfather was a producer for some of Woody Allen's biggest films. She'd get to meet all these great movie stars and celebrities, sometimes even go on set, too. So, it's an obvious question. All that time around filmmakers, that's what inspired her, right?
No. On the film sets that I was on as a little kid and then later as a production assistant, I was nowhere near the director or the action. And I didn't know what was going on. You know, I'd see the director whisper into an actor's ear, and I couldn't imagine what brilliant advice he was giving her. Now I know. It's like sit to the left.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, one of my favorite filmmakers, Nicole Holofcener. In over 25 years of making movies, she's shown an incredible talent at making understated, compelling films with strong, fascinating female leads. This time around, though, she thought, why not try a movie about a dude? I mean, somebody's got to make a movie about a dude, right?
No, I thought we needed one more because there is such a shortage. I know. I like men, and I know they have feelings, too, and have legitimate problems, and I loved the characters and the problems they had. So there you go, guys.
Thanks, Nicole. Then we'll talk with the creator and showrunner behind the new show, Lodge 49. It's a funny, weird series that is in part about fraternal orders and secret societies and how, well, how they're kind of boring.
It's basically, you know, people who by day are working, you know, a daylight grind, and at night they can go into the space and be, you know, a knight of the brazen serpent or something like that. And I don't know, I find that a very human wish to add some grandeur to your life.
Then for our outshot, Michael Jackson sang some of the greatest pop hits of all time. But who was the real genius behind those tracks? I mean, it was Michael Jackson. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. First up, Nicole Holofcener. She's a writer and director. She makes quiet films, usually a little melancholic. Her protagonists are usually women. They're almost always complex, flawed. If you haven't seen her work, it's brilliant. She was profiled in The New Yorker recently, and I think this line sums up her films pretty well. Often, movies are about people confronting extraordinary problems and overcoming them. Holofcener's films tend to be about people confronting ordinary circumstances and falling short because they're afraid of getting hurt or of getting old or simply of changing. Holofcener has worked with some brilliant actors as well, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and James Gandolfini in Enough Said, Catherine Keener and Frances McDormand in Friends with Money, Catherine Keener in, like, all of her movies. Holofcener's latest film was just released on Netflix. It's called The Land of Steady Habits. It's based on the novel by Ted Thompson. And for the first time, her movie centers on a man. His name is Anders. He's a middle-aged, retired finance guy, played by Ben Mendelsohn. Anders is going through kind of a late midlife crisis. He's just left his wife, played by Edie Falco. But they still live in the same Tony community in Connecticut. He's worried about his adult son. He's doing drugs, and he's just having trouble figuring out where he fits in these days. Like in this scene from early on in the film, Anders is getting a drink with his friend Larry, who's also divorced. And Anders is having regrets. His family has moved on a lot easier than he thought they would after he left. And as we're about to hear, Larry is trying to comfort him.
I used to have this vision of my life. It was like a web and these threads that connected me, you know?
Yeah.
And that the more webs you could have coming from you, then the more important you were, right? Like, so if you're a doctor, you cure a bunch of
patients.
Then, or a teacher, you got a million threads, you know? And you would be basically irreplaceable, right? Because so many people depended on you, right? You understand what I'm saying?
It's webs. And...
Yeah, but it's really not the case.
Come on, man.
No, it's the web. The web is remaking itself, revising itself every second of every day. And so if you vanish, then the people that were in your life, they learn to rely on someone else, you know? And you're gone. And then the web just remakes itself and moves on without you.
Nicole Hollis-Center, I'm so glad to have you back on Bullseye. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
This movie's kind of about dudes.
Yeah. I guess they're male.
I mean, there's central female characters in the story as well. But there's a father and two sons who are really the heart of this movie. And I wonder if you had to, like, choose that you could make a movie about dudes, because I don't know if you know this, there are a lot of movies about dudes already.
No, I thought we needed one more because there is such a shortage. I know. A dude's having a midlife crisis too, right?
Yeah, finally.
How original. But I love the story so much, and the fact that it has dudes was nice. I like men, and I know they have feelings too, and have legitimate problems, and I loved the characters and the problems they had. So there you go, guys.
Was it something where, I sincerely don't believe you have a special responsibility to chronicle the lives of women?
Thank you. Nor do I.
Okay. So let's stipulate to that.
Mm-hmm.
But did you have to think about it for a second and say, okay, this is going to be about dudes. All my other movies were mostly, not exclusively, but mostly about women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay for me to make a movie about dudes. I've made a lot of movies, and it's not my job to fix Hollywood.
No, nor can I, unfortunately. No, I mean—
I was wondering why you hadn't so far.
Yeah, I was trying. I gave up. I just go where my heart follows. I am not making political statements with my movies, certainly not with this one. You know, in the political climate that is right now, this is not the movie that, you know, someone should be making. Yet, why not? This is a beautiful story, I think, and there's room for that, no matter the gender.
How is it different for you to direct? You direct a lot of television, including some of my favorite television. You directed some of my favorite Bored to Deaths, for example, which is one of my favorite shows ever.
The Case of the Stolen Sperm?
Yeah.
It was a good one.
How is it different for you as someone who has, for the most part, written the movies that you direct? Like, it's this big, intense 5-year process for you to get a movie into theaters because, you know, you're making small to medium scale movies, writing them yourself. You know, presumably working on producing them as well, and so on and so forth. Like, it's this big deal. Whereas when you're directing television, you're just like there for a little while on where everyone else knows each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it can be really uncomfortable, like being the new kid at school each time.
But the new kid at school isn't in charge.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's what's weird about it.
That's true. You have to listen to me and you don't know me. And I'm on your turf. There's only been a couple of times where I felt really uncomfortable. And that played out exactly as you said. Like, it just was kind of torturous. Where I think the actors were sick of visiting directors, sick of being directed by people who didn't, you know, aren't there all the time. Or it's an unhappy set. But generally, I felt really welcomed and actors wanted to be directed by me, so phew.
Do you think that your skill set is suited to what a television director does?
I think a certain kind of television director, certainly certain kind of shows. I wouldn't know what to do with a 3-camera show, you know, in that, like a sitcom or anything. I'd be lost. But the shows that I direct feel like little movies. Or if they don't, you know, I just direct them as if I was directing a movie. I don't see any difference, except that I have to please the writer and the producer. And since I work on shows that I really like or love, then I feel honored to do that. So it's good.
Does it come easily to you? I mean, as someone who has successfully directed many films where you are, you know, in a film, that director is the be-all, end-all, at least, you know.
I am?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Is that, wait, what your question
is
was?
Is the fact that you're...
Oh, does it come easily to me?
Doing this job and you're doing it to please someone else, ultimately.
Right.
Like, you have artistic input as well, but you have to do it the way that they like it. In mm-hmm. some ways, you have to match the way other people have done it to some extent and so on and so forth.
Yeah. In fact, I try to. You know, I don't feel like I have to reinvent this show with my vision. I feel respectful of what's already come before. And I do want to have my voice in there, a little stamp in there. But, yeah, I want it to be kind of seamless, not notice like, oh, that actor's finally good or that actor's finally bad. People compliment me on my specific episodes, and I don't feel really right to take credit. I feel like can I curse on this show?
Well, I will bleep it out.
I didn't f*** it up. You know, if I don't screw it up, then I've done my job. You know, if I did a good job, that's even better. But, yeah, it's different to want to please somebody else, yes. And so it's more like a job in that respect. Like, I can't overrule anybody's taste. I can't always rely on my own taste. But so far, people have wanted my taste. They've trusted me enough, mostly, to do it. And, you know, it's a great job. I make good money in residuals and meet actors I would never meet or DPs that I might want to work with. You know, it's better than sitting, you know, in my house writing forever.
Do you find yourself, when you're working on television, doing more asking rather than telling? I mean, I presume that when you're on a movie, especially when you've written it, and someone says, I'm not sure what this is, you're the one who knows.
I should. Right? I hope.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't. But, right, on a TV show, I might say, so how would you react in this? You know, and what came right before this? Or what about this character should I be aware of? Yeah. And then I tell them. Have to tell at some point.
I think there are a lot of directors who, you know, one of the reasons that they became directors, other than, you know, their
power.
Well, it's not necessarily because they desired power, but because they were comfortable wielding it. Like, I think that one of the reasons that people with social privilege are disproportionately represented in the ranks of directors is because they don't question their
entitlement.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, totally.
Is that what you were going to say?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say, yeah, well, we go back to privilege maybe, but privilege and entitlement often go hand in hand, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, you said the straight white dude?
To the straight white woman.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
I'm more comfortable directing than I am sitting right here, not right now, talking to you. I'm more nervous right now, imagining that this is going to be on the airwaves and the sound of my voice and all that crap. But when I'm directing, of course I get nervous and of course I make mistakes, but it really feels like I'm in the right place. I'm utilizing all of the creativity that I have that I want to express. It sounds corny, but it's true.
Did you feel that way when you were young? I mean, you spent time on movie sets as a kid because your stepfather was a legendary producer. Did you look at that and think, this is something I want or something I could do when you were a teenager or whatever?
No. On the film sets that I was on as a little kid and then later as a production assistant, I was nowhere near the director or the action, and I didn't know what was going on. You know, I'd see the director whisper into an actor's ear, and I couldn't imagine what brilliant advice he was giving her. Now I know. It's like sit to the left, sit up straight. So I didn't know what really directing was, or it didn't occur to me that I could do that at all.
So how did you come to believe that you could? Because I think at some point you have to believe that you could in order to actually do it, right?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? I wonder what made me think I could do it. I directed a short at NYU that was probably one of the worst times in my life. I mean, making the movie, I was so in over my head that I literally wished I would get hit by a car. I was so anxious. I was really like one of the first times I felt serious anxiety. And then my producer, who was in over his head, was throwing up in the bathroom. And the movie cost too much money and took forever. And then I thought, okay, I'll be a writer. And then I started writing a bunch and went to Columbia grad school for writing. See? But they make you direct videos. And so when I was directing the videos, I thought, okay, I'm better at this now. I like this. And they turned out well. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try directing again.
You grew up part in New York and partly in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And you moved from one to the other when you were like 12.
Exactly.
I cannot imagine a time in my life when I would less like to have a disjuncture that big.
Yeah, that was rough. Was my choice. Although, at the time, I was in with a bunch of mean girls when I was 12 in New York City. And I seemed to be drawn to mean girls. I was when I was younger.
Were you cool?
No, I think
you
I guess
were.
I,
if you were with the mean girls, that's the cool kids.
I think I was a little cool, and then they realized how vulnerable I was. Then they realized what a target I was. And so they were funny, you know? Mean girls are funny and smart, and I was drawn to that, and then until they turn on me, then they're not. And when I was leaving New York, that was sort of happening, and I was looking forward to getting away from these girls. But moving away from my dad at the time was really hard. He lived in, you know, near the city. And of course I, you know, was drawn to more mean girls. And then I got bullied in my new school. And eventually I found some real good friends. But yeah, I had long hair down to here. I had zits, you know, I didn't wear a bra. It was like New York in the 60s or 70s. Completely different than the Los Angeles girls. And I tried to be one.
What was it like when you got to Los Angeles?
I had to take the bus, which was really weird. I was used to the subway, and walk to a bus, which was very strange. And I felt like I didn't fit in until I started buying the clothes everybody else was. And then before I knew it, I fit in. I don't know. I just did. And we got to have a dog and a completely different lifestyle. You know, New York was pretty rough in the early 70s and 60s, and I was exposed to a lot of stuff. I got, you know, flashed a bunch of times when I was a kid in New York, and then I came to L.A. and I was on the bus and some guy was doing it, and I'm like, but I'm in L.A. What, do they follow me here?
Don't they see the palm trees?
Exactly. I thought only the perverts only lived in New York, but alas, they're everywhere.
That sucks.
It does. And all of us, all my friends, we were all aware of it. So we joke about it and try to act tough about it. But it was scarring.
Did you have to be tough about stuff in general? Did you have to have that kind of toughness just walking around? That
in New
kind
York.
Of like eyes up. You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Especially in New York. I mean, I took the subway when I was like 8 with my sister and so we were hyper aware and vigilant and acted tough until, you know, we got threatened. And then, you know, we were puddles of tears. But I think I still act tough. I think people think I'm tough, and I'm so not tough. My feelings get hurt just like everyone else's, or more, I like to think, or it feels like I do. But that I have a kind of gruff, blunt exterior. That doesn't really, well, you know, it is a part of me, but so is the other.
Do you think that's partly because show business is very unforgiving, and if you are a sensitive person, you'd better have a gruff, blunt exterior, because otherwise you're going to die from all the people telling you exactly what's wrong with the things that you created that are the most important?
I know. No, that's where I turn into a puddle of tears. But Yeah, this is a very tough competitive business. I've had, you know, been destroyed emotionally a million times, and I'm one of the lucky ones. So just imagine. And also, it's just part of my personality. I think it's part of my humor is that I can be kind of blunt and outspoken, and it makes me seem like I'm a tough girl. And then I find out I'm hurting someone's feelings, and I'm not so tough. I'm just an idiot.
Is there a time that you can tell me of a time that you regretted something that you were being having a tough girl, blunt, outspokenness about?
I was probably telling somebody that I didn't know that they had bad breath. Because I'd want someone to tell me. Or, you know, I've accused someone I barely know. You're like, did you fart? And because I just, I like talking about things that we all know about but don't talk about. I have that kind of thrill. And I'm sure I've offended people, especially with the breath thing.
I mean, that's like a big part of your movies, not bad breath specifically, although there is some chewing sounds talk in the new movie.
There isn't bad breath in Friends with Money. Yeah. There I go. Yeah.
But it's obvious that you get such a kick out of airing something that is supposed to be an intimate secret.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so much of Friends with Money was about that for me. It was exciting in that way. I like to ask, if I'm sitting with a close friend and they're talking about a good job they just got, I might say, oh, how much are you making? And to see the look on their face, like, is it safe to tell you? What will you think of me? And I often just tell someone what I'm making because I know they want to know. And I'm either thrilled or ashamed or embarrassed, but that's what it is. I think people have too many secrets. People are too ashamed in general, including myself.
We'll continue my conversation with Nicole Holof Center after a quick break. She'll tell me why she isn't really interested in making movies about people who are likable. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message come from Squarespace. If you're ready to start your new business, get your unique domain, and create a beautiful website with help from Squarespace's 24/7 award-winning customer support, head to squarespace.com/bullseye for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code Bullseye to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR Spanish language podcast Radio Ambulante. We're back with a new season with 36 stories from all over Latin America and the Latino community here in the U.S. From one of the most controversial trials in Puerto Rico's history to the Venezuelan migrant crisis. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Biv.
And I'm Teresa.
And we host When Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting.
Whether you are a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent. And then that's how my day starts.
Yeah.
Come on. I'm so sick of it. When is that going to be over? Like, I want it to stop.
Teresa, you're hurting my ears.
I mean, that's it.
Yeah, no, that's...
I just hate it.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It sucks.
It really sucks.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Right now I'm talking with Nicole Holof Center. She's a writer and director. Some of her films include Friends with Money and Enough Said. She's also worked on TV shows like Parks and Recreation, Orange is the New Black, and Sex and the City. Her latest project is a film called The Land of Steady Habits. It's out now on Netflix. This movie, The Land of Steady Habits, is about substantially parents' relationships with their children.
Mm-hmm.
I found that it terrified me.
As it should. Yeah, I understand. Terrifies me, too.
Was that part of what resonated with you when you read the novel, the kind of terror of not knowing what your children would be and not being able to control it?
I think so. Yeah, consciously or unconsciously, that's... I mean, I worry about my 20-year-old twin boys all the time. And it's a real lesson to let them be who they are and to try not to worry and to stay out of their hair. You know, the drug years are really scary, whether they did drugs or not. You know, you're just in terror. And they lie and do all the normal things. But these characters, I guess, were kind of a mother's worst fear, one more than another. But, you know, Preston's character is really, like, he goes to Northwestern and then he lays on the couch. I mean, that's a really scary prospect.
Let's hear another clip from my guest, Nicole Holofcener's new film, which is called The Land of Steady Habits. Anders is the protagonist of the film, and in this scene, he's hanging out with Charlie, who's the teenage son of some family friends. They're both getting high, and Charlie just talked about how he doesn't understand his dad. Anders starts talking about his own son, Preston.
You know why? Because when he was a kid, he had this big, floppy bear. It was like a big, saggy, shitty bear, and he carried it everywhere, and I mean everywhere, and he held on to that thing way too long, way past the time when anyone's supposed to be hanging on to a bear, you know. So we took it off him and we hid it and we pretended that it was lost because we were, I don't know, we were worried about him being teased or that he wouldn't grow up or some bullshit. I don't know. I mean, oh God, he was so betrayed. We betrayed him. He was devastated. He was heartbroken. What a stupid thing to be a parent.
It's sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. That Ted Thompson, he's a good novelist. And Ben Mendelsohn, good actor.
You're actually a very good writer and director.
Thank you.
In my opinion.
Thanks.
Have you ever retrospectively thought, wow, I failed my child in a way that I did not realize at the time?
Sure.
I don't think anyone fails their children on purpose.
No, of course not. I'm sure. And I'll find out more as they get older and angrier and we start having therapy sessions together. Certainly. I will learn more. And I have to accept that. You know, I want to be a perfect parent. I never want to hurt my kids. And to find out, you know, you who are supposed to protect your child has hurt them is just a really horrible feeling. But we all make mistakes. And that, you know, I've made some, I'm sure.
Do you worry about whether you're doing the right thing as much as the characters in your movies do?
Oh, gee. Yeah, I suppose I am aware. I worry if I'm doing the right thing. Yeah, right? Not as much. I mean, you know, the character that Ben Mendelsohn plays, you know, he makes a lot of mistakes. He's not doing the right thing. I'm not drawn to those kind of mistakes, thankfully. I think I have a better head on my shoulders, but that doesn't keep me from, you know, being insecure about how I behaved somewhere, what I said, or what I'm saying right now. Whose feelings am I going to hurt or whatever. Yeah.
Your movies have such sympathy for people who are making mistakes. There isn't anybody in your movies who isn't making mistakes for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no, you know, there's not a lot of Hercules in your movies.
No, there aren't. I can think of Simon McBurney in Friends with Money. He was a pretty good guy and being torn apart by his wife, who had a lot of problems. But he kind of shows himself, I think, to be a well-rounded, healthy person.
Are you, like, constantly making a list in your head of Catherine Keener's and Edie Falco's and James Gandolfini's,
Julia Louis-Dreyfus,
these people that can do jerky, mean little things, and you still just want to give them a hug?
Yeah, and a lead in a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the land of steady habits. You know, Ben Mendelsohn plays this kind of somewhat reprehensible person, really selfish, narcissistic, insecure, ashamed, lonely person who makes bad mistakes and, you know, when I was casting the movie or thinking about who I wanted, I felt like he had all of that in his face. He could have all of that in his face. He's such a good actor. And also it's, you know, sometimes it's the way someone talks or it's literally the shape of their face, you know. Like Catherine, I don't know, everything she says and does makes it more interesting to me than most actors. So
she's really funny. Like, can really nail a joke. She kind of has a little bit of sad eyes.
Yes, absolutely.
And so everything is colored a little bit by the sad eyes.
Which I love.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you cast her in the proper thing, that's fantastic. But that's what makes her deep. And same with Ben. Ben has sad eyes. Look at those eyes. I mean, he just draws you in. And I hope that, you know, people, they don't have to love him or like him, but as long as you're immersed in his growth or his story and entertained by it, great.
I was thinking when I watched the movie Mission Impossible.
Yes.
That Tom Cruise, and I may be about to mess up my chances of ever having time. Tom Cruise, if you're listening to this right now, you're more than welcome to come on this program. I'd be fascinated to talk with you.
He's not listening.
You don't seem like a real human being. but I know you are. I know you must be because I believe all people are.
Yes.
But like Tom Cruise in that movie, like he's superhuman, right?
You
should watch it. It's a totally great movie.
Yeah.
But he's superhuman in it. And he's absolutely credible as superhuman because of his astonishing and apparent certitude. Like the conviction, and he must just be like this because he must know how to enhance it for the screen. But like he must have some, this must be a real quality of his.
Well, we've seen it, I think, in interviews. And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, when people have laughed at him for seeming unhinged, it is for that exact same reason, right?
The couch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is like one quality of movie stardom, which is you can credibly be
anything.
Like beyond the world.
Uh-huh.
Like anything in the world. I feel like the other quality of movie stardom is if you can be a jerk and we believe that you are doing your best.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And like you for that.
Right. Doing your best. That counts for a lot. It does. I don't have any elaboration on that.
Have you ever seen the show Always Sunny? It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
I love that show.
So I love it too. I'm amazed that it's still so great 13 years in or however long they've been making it.
I really want to work with Caitlin Olsen so bad.
She's amazing. She's so brilliant and hilarious in that show.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, why do I like these characters who are monsters in literally every way and idiots?
Yes.
They're both idiots and monsters. They're not just amoral. They're immoral almost always.
And they think they're terrific people.
They're completely deluded. Like, and I was like, okay, well, number one, they're friends, and I like things about friends. And number two, they're doing their best.
Right. Actually, they don't think they're good people. They know they're bad people, but they're doing their best at being themselves.
Yeah. Something like that.
Getting what they want. No, it's relentlessly funny, and they're all, you know, reprehensible. Yeah. Love it.
Like when I remember watching Friends with Money, mm-hmm. being mad at every character in the movie. Like,
really?
Yes.
In a bad way.
No, not in a bad way.
Uh-huh.
I actually really like your movies, as I've said a bunch of times so far. You're one of my all-time faves.
Thank you.
Nicole. But like watching and being mad
at these jerks.
At all these jerks, right? But still really caring about them, wanting happiness for them.
Mm-hmm.
And like believing in them in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that is not a common thing in film. Maybe you get one person like that in a movie. You know, you get one Catherine Keener.
Mm-hmm.
You tend to make construct movies out of those people.
Yeah, I guess they're all, you know, people inside of me and my life. You know, people in my life. And it's just not interesting to make easygoing, likable people. I mean, even the dude, you know, easygoing, likable person. But boy, does he up. But he's doing his best. Yeah, that's just what's interesting to me. I like to see movies about you know, if it's not going to be conflict like, you know, finding the buried treasure, it better be conflict within somebody's soul.
Nicole Holofcener, I'm so grateful to you for coming back on the show and for your movies as well. I just admire them so much.
Thank you so much. That makes me happy.
Nicole Holofcener, one of my all-time faves. The Land of Steady Habits is streaming now on Netflix. You can watch it. And hey, here's a hot tip. If you didn't see Enough Said, like, I think it was one of the most lovely and moving and hilarious romantic comedies of the last 10 or 20 years. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Have you heard about this show, Lodge 49? It's new. It's on AMC, and I am pretty into it. It's about a guy named Sean Dudley, who goes by, appropriately, Dud. He's a 30-something burnout. He lives in Long Beach, where he was born and raised. He used to be a surfer, but he got bit by a snake, literally bit by a snake, and now he can't surf. He hangs out at a donut shop, and if you know a place where he can crash tonight, he's all ears. Anyway, one day he is metal detecting on a beach, and he finds a ring, and he asks around, and it turns out that it belongs to a lodge for this secret society, the Order of the Lynx, sort of like the Freemasons or the Elks. The ring brings him into the lodge, and before long, he's a member. He's fascinated by the robes and rituals, charmed and befriended by the members. He gets swept up by the mythology and mystery. Here's what's great about the show, the Order, the secret society. It is just a bunch of people. Most of them are about 20, 30 years older than Dud. They rent out their throne room to a bingo club. The plumbing drips a little bit. It's been a very long time since they've had a new member. And when you're watching the show, you're constantly asking yourself, is fate intervening in Dud's life? Or is this just luck, happenstance? I talked with Jim Gavin, the show's creator, and Peter Ocko, who is a television veteran who was showrunner and executive producer of Lodge 49. You'll hear from them in a second. But first, let's listen to a little bit from the show's pilot. Dud's truck just ran out of gas just outside the lodge, coincidentally. And he just found that ring, so he decides to walk across the street and return it. He knocks on the door, and he's greeted by Ernie, played by Brent Jennings, an officer at the lodge. In this scene, Dud asks Ernie about joining up.
I hate to admit it, but someone asking to join is a rare event these days.
Really?
Our membership's been declining for years. Maybe this is a good sign. We need to get younger. I'll just need your contact info.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, what is it that you guys do here?
Community services, recreational activities. Plus, there's a whole philosophical component, alchemical or whatever you want to call it.
Oh.
But mainly, we just get together. Tonight's bunko night.
Well, that sounds great.
You do understand we may not take you. For all I know, you could be some kind of deadbeat or psycho.
Definitely not a psycho.
Guys, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have the two of you on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Jim, this was a show that you created. What drew you initially into the world of fraternal orders?
I've always kind of been obsessed with sort of the history of secret societies and kind of esoterica and all that, both for its kind of strange buried histories and systems of belief and ritual and stuff, but mainly for the human element of the type of person who joins these things, particularly in their more modern expression. Something like Freemasons or the Elks. Elks are more of a social club than a esoteric. But it's basically, you know, people who by day are working, the daylight grind. And at night, they can go into the space and be, you know, a knight of the Brazen Serpent or something like that. And there's just a sense of, I find that a very human wish to add some grandeur to your life. And I think it's also a world that feels like it's been on its way out for a while. You drive by these places in Southern California, they feel very dusty and moribund and feel like a bit of a relic, but they're still open, you know. And our story is basically, one of the stories we're telling is a possible rebirth of a particular lodge when a young man knocks on the door. So, yeah, I think we created our own, the Ancient and Benevolent Order of the Lynx, and it has its own crazy history and mythology. It is kind of, you know, combines some histories of Freemasonry and is inspired by certain things. But it's its own thing, has its own system of belief and metaphor and stuff. So that was its kind of own joy and pleasure. But the real joy and pleasure just watching, Dud knock on the door and meet Ernie.
Was the fact that it is in Southern California but not in Los Angeles also important to the two of you?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me that's naturally the environment I write about. You know, I'm Long Beach and Orange County are areas I know very well. My family's there and I grew up there and all these things. And so for me it is in the dumbest way possible, which is maybe the best way. So I write what I know and a certain type of people. And I think one thing about Southern California, the setting, is that, and we try to capture this in the show, is that kind of sun-baked, almost oppressive sunlight versus the interior of the lodge, which is dark and dim and cool and has the feeling of a retreat from, like, the daily grind. And I think for whatever reason that is, that juxtaposition is more drastic in Southern California, in my mind, in some sense. So, yeah, so it's set there because that's kind of where I know, but we also go very much into the history of Long Beach and aerospace and all these things. So yeah, no, like Los Angeles doesn't even register on the minds of our characters at all.
Yeah, I think too, it's the kind of place that people have heard of, but they don't know. So you can't shorthand it when you hear it, and you can't think you know it already. And for us too, there's because of that. We talk a lot about the kingdom of Long Beach, where it is a real place with real people that Jim certainly knows inside and out. But it's also this to the idea of being the brazen knight. There's a place where things can happen which aren't necessarily something you'd see in straightforward daylight.
Yeah, yeah. The light in Southern California is unique, and I'm not the first person to note this, and I feel it every time I'm gone for a while. When we were in Atlanta shooting, I was gone for probably, like 3 months, and I just remember just entering, getting out of, just stepping out of LAX. The light is does have this, it depending how you're feeling personally, it can either be a gift or like an almost oppressive thing. And Long Beach, on top of that, I think has an even more particular light that I feel. And we were able to, I think, capture that in some moments because we did shoot there for a couple weeks. Yeah.
I mean, for us, the moment of sort of stepping out of the dark lodge into the light and then seeing it and it's just too bright and you have to shut the door and go back. It's the experience of being in a hole in the wall bar and coming out. It's not the idyllic, paradise light. It's the opposite. It's this kind of, you'd rather retreat.
Yeah. More with Peter Ocko and Jim Gavin after a break. Stick around. Their show Lodge 49 is set in Long Beach, California. Jim Gavin was born in Long Beach. Coming up, some extremely Long Beach-specific questions. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message come from Starbucks. Introducing new Starbucks Plus Coffee K-Cup Pods, the coffee that keeps up with you. With twice the caffeine compared to one pod of Starbucks K-Cup coffee, it's an extra boost to help you make the most of your day. Available in Starbucks Blonde, Medium, and Dark Roast K-Cup Pods for the rich taste you love. Look for new Starbucks Plus Coffee where you buy groceries.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks, we got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we're the host of Everything's
Coming Up, Simpsons.
Every episode, we cover a different episode of The Simpsons that is a favorite of our special guests.
We've had guests that are showrunners and writers and voice actors like Nancy Cartwright.
I got a D minus, I passed!
And we've also had people that are on the Max Fun Network already.
Homer wearing that golf outfit is so funny. It. And then when he gets super into golf, he's wearing the golf hat in bed.
We've had Weird Al Yankovic on the show.
I was just struck by how sharp the writing is. I mean, yeah. That's no surprise because it's The Simpsons, but I mean, like, you can't say that about a lot of TV shows, particularly ones that at that point had been on the air for 14 years.
Find us on MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, smell you later.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Right now I'm talking with Jim Gavin and Peter Ocko. Jim created the new TV show Lodge 49. It's a little tough to say what it's about, but some of the themes include secret societies, quarter-life crises, and the stagnating aerospace economy in Long Beach, California. Peter Ocko is a writer, executive producer, and showrunner on Lodge 49. It seems to me like, and tell me what you think of this assertion, there is some kind of parallel between the way that Dud's combination of optimism and naivete, when he looks upon the world, kind of gives the story a way to, like, look at normal things in a new way that parallels the ways that the kind of metaphors of the mysticism of these fraternal orders are a way of looking at the world through new eyes.
I would say, as an answer to that, the one index card we had in our writer's room above everything else was the idea of alchemy, which is, can you get something from nothing? And I think Dud sort of embodies that, you know.
Yeah. And I think the central metaphor for the Lynx order is vision and seeing, and how, like, the magnum opus of alchemy is, can, there are many different ideas of what it actually means, but I think in our land, it kind of just means having an experience of the unseen, or seeing the world in a new way where it feels new. And I think on some level, Dud does that naturally. He just sees things at a different angle from everybody else, which, you know, causes no shortage of problems for him. And it is often delusional, but I think he's someone who, the delusion might actually save him at different points in his life, as far in addition to causing him a lot of grief.
There is a mentorship relationship at the center of this show between Dud and an older guy named Ernie, who is both the guy who happens to be inside when he knocks on the door,
yeah,
and a guy who is next in line to become the boss of the lodge.
Yeah.
And Ernie is a pretty regular dude, a plumbing parts salesman, a salesman to plumbers,
yeah,
that is. And he's African-American, and he's like maybe like 60-ish, something mm-hmm. like that. In a world where people want 60-year-old dudes to be like either magical or invisible.
Yeah.
And especially 60-year-old African-American guys, like either they want it to be Samuel L. Jackson or Morgan Freeman,
yeah,
you know, like guys who have more charisma than God. I mean, Morgan, yeah, Freeman often plays God, but like the most charismatic, coolest, most remarkable human beings on earth, or just completely unseen.
Right.
How do you fill that role? Like, how do you decide?
Yeah, I mean, the character is, you know, a composite of people in my life, and in particular, a basketball coach I had in high school, and who I was very close with, and when my basketball career ended, and I was in a moment of difficult moment in my life, someone basically helped me in a way that I think was crucial, and it's always stayed with me.
Can you tell me what that was?
Just like my family my dad had lost his job, and everything was falling apart. He basically, I went and coached with him, and I just had a purpose. And from when I'm looking back now, or with a little bit of, I could see how screwed up his life was. And just because he was making all these dumb decisions in his life doesn't mean he wasn't doing this amazing thing for other people, you know. And but it is, you know, it's a character, as I mentioned, he's very much comes out of a Long Beach world and upbringing in a particular part of Long Beach. But that's the character. But it's played by Brent Jennings, who, when we saw him, he's a guy who I think a lot of people recognize from as a character actor and stuff. But he embodied that kind of everyman Leopold Bloom a fully just he just has these nooks and crannies. He's an odd guy.
So he's surprising in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And you look at him and you think you know him, and then he'll say something that just you realize there's many more dimensions to this guy. And that's Ernie, you know.
Yeah. So I think, he's a guy who still he's finding out life doesn't just. He's at its point. You never think you're going to be that old, but he still has this fight ahead of him. Like, he still has to live this life. And I don't know. So he and Wyatt really do kind of – they just the way he embodied those characters is a joy to watch.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, next season he does get a magical staff that summons lightning.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we're heading that direction.
Did you screen test every actor with a staff?
We knew it was we wanted to hold off for one season, but you're right, it's coming.
Let's hear a scene with Ernie, played by Brent Jennings. He goes to a dispensary, and the dispensary is owned by a character named Blaze, subtly named Blaze. And Blaze is played by David Pasquese, who's a sort of legendary Chicago improv guy. He's great in the show. And he is a guy who he's probably the guy who's most invested in the mystical world of the lodge.
Yeah.
I have your Earth, Wind, and Fire kit ready to go. Now, everything you need is right in there, including instructions. Mm-hmm. Once it's mixed together, just rub it into his fur or wherever there's irritation.
Thank you. And Fernando thanks you.
See you at the tavern tonight?
No, after work I'm playing nine with Larry, and I've got other stuff.
Hot date?
What? No.
Are you okay? You look stressed.
I'm not sleeping. It's the crows in my neighborhood. They wake me up every morning. They're everywhere.
Signs and symbols, Ernie. The augury of birds, man. Mm. Come on. Paracelsus says this sort of thing usually foretells doom.
Fantastic.
I mean, that's just an FYI.
It seems to me like maybe the thing that I respond to the most in Lodge 49 is simply that I would like to watch television shows that aspire to art. Like, I like artfulness. And there are so few that do not signpost their artfulness through depicting unpleasantness. Mm-hmm. And there are shows, like, I love Mad Men too.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong.
And we do. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like, it's the greatest. It's a totally amazing television program that totally blew my mind. I watch every episode. It's great. But at some point, like, I'm so excited to get to watch a TV show that is artful, aspires to be artful. It's like intentionally artful, but also isn't curdled, isn't about what's awful about the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think any – it's kind of dishonest either way. Like a straight – something that's so just all jokes and rah-rah doesn't feel true, and something that is so – and this is what I feel mostly intelligent, so battering and bleak, that on some level is a pretense in its own way. And the way I understand life is and during some of my darkest moments, I've had some of my biggest laughs and some of my most happy moments. There's a shadow of melancholy, you know, and it is a challenge to depict that. But I think that's where, you know, we love it, you know, that we can move through different moods in a way and not rely, you know, on, you know, a dead body on the floor, although, you know, we'll get there eventually. But, you know, yeah, so it's I don't know. I wouldn't say I'm an artist or anything or, you know, but collaboratively, I think there's a level of trust in what we're trying to do and the detail in it that I don't know. The word I like is offhand. Like, I think some of our biggest moves are kind of offhand, you know. Hopefully it's a show that rewards a second viewing, because you'll see things in the background and setups and stuff that you may have missed the first time.
Signs and augers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's thrilling to be mistaken for art. and I think for us, you know, the guiding light is always what makes us happy, like what makes us giggle, and letting the characters kind of lead instead of feeling like we're trying to fill a formula.
And the other thing is between, you know, like Brent, Wyatt, Sonya Cassidy, who plays Liz, who's a huge figure on her show, David, Eric, and Linda are kind of really, they all have a unique kind of, they do have a comic sensibility, even though they've all done many different types of things. But the, their sensibility is particular to the character in a way. And that's just really fun to write to, you know. So.
Okay, Jim, you are in part from Long Beach. I think you spend a lot of time in Orange, California. I have both the producer of this show, Kevin, and our production fellow, Chewy, are from Long Beach and have lived in Long Beach.
Okay.
They're both graduates of CSU Long Beach.
Okay, as is my sister.
Okay, so congratulations to all the waves. Is that what it is?
49ers.
49ers, okay.
That was a trick question right there. Well done, Jim.
Here's your Long Beach questions. This is like a lightning round. Where in Long Beach did you have your first drink?
In Long Beach would be Murphy's, I think. I'm not proud of this, on 2nd Street. I knew the bartender there, Andy Horn, if you're listening.
I feel like you were
10.
Yeah.
You having described already a bar, just a design for a bar that moved you to tears, that was like you calling yourself out.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Enjoy a drink.
Okay. What's the best place for tacos? And be aware that I'm worried. I don't know for sure, but I'm worried this is a test of some kind.
Okay. I can't say it's the best. My favorite place to get a taco is Coco Reno's. One, because I used to live near it, and it's a just very cozy place. And you can take it into the order into the bar next door. And they do.
Again, you're calling yourself out.
Yeah. So, I'm a little out of. My sister lives in Long Beach, or one of my sisters, and she's probably more up on the contemporary taco scene.
My notes here say that if you had said "Holy moly," that I should end the interview because you're a fraud.
Okay, great.
So you're safe from that. Do you own a T-shirt from Joe Jost's?
Actually, I do. As of very recently,
my producer Kevin is so excited to talk about this T-shirt. He tried to explain it to me.
No, it was a gift. one of our lovely editors, Sheridan, who was from Long Beach, graduate of Long Beach Poly, she gave me a Joe Jost shirt. So yes.
Jim, Peter, thank you so much for taking this time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to get to talk to you about your wonderful show.
Awesome.
Thank you.
It was fun. Thanks, dude.
Jim Gavin and Peter Ocko, the creator and showrunner of AMC's Lodge 49, respectively. Lodge 49 is in the middle of its debut season right now. You can watch a new episode every Monday at 10 p.m., 9 Central. And if you get AMC, you can also watch the whole first season on the AMC website. I've really been enjoying watching it. Give it a look. Every week on Bullseye, we like to leave you with a culture tip before we go. It's called the Outshot. Maybe because Michael Jackson always seemed like a child, it's easy to dismiss his artistry. Not the large-scale impact that he had. You can't deny his stardom. But in contrast to, say, Prince, it's easy to think of Michael as a naif. MJ wasn't a one-man band. He didn't write some of his greatest tracks. One time he brought a chimp to the Grammys. It's easy to think of Michael as an incredible instrument that was being played by others, by his dad, by Quincy Jones, whoever. I mean, I had a Michael Jackson doll as a kid, and I thought of him that way. And yeah, Michael wasn't Prince. He didn't write a lot of his songs, and he didn't play the instruments, and he never had that kind of white-knuckle control over his art. But for all those things that he wasn't, there is one thing that Michael Jackson still was. A genius.
We're going to be starting now, baby. Don't stop till you get enough. Don't stop till you get enough.
This is the home demo of Don't Stop Till You Get Enough,
the single that pushed Michael to solo stardom. He's 19 or 20 here. His brother Randy's playing the piano. A few of his brothers and sisters are helping with percussion and so forth, banging on Coke bottles. Michael wrote this song. It's his first R&B number one. There's no strings, a rough mix, and there is a genuine genius on the vocals. Michael wasn't much of an instrumentalist. I mean, he could bang out a song on a piano if he needed to. He was a singer and a dancer, and he was transcendently brilliant at those things. Justin Timberlake and Usher and Bruno Mars can all sing and dance. They are all brilliant, but they are all tribute acts when you put them next to Michael. Jackson's greatest albums were polished to an almost blinding sheen. But listen to him sing She's Out of My Life, accompanied by a guitar. Just a guitar.
She's out of my life. She's out of my life. I don't know whether or cry. I don't know whether to live or die, and it cuts like a knife. She's out of my life.
By the time this song made it to Off the Wall, it had strings and the whole nine yards. I mean, if Slash had been famous in 1979, they might have brought him in to throw a solo on there so it could make rock radio. But what makes it magic is Michael's voice.
Damn indecision and cursed pride. The love I kept for her, like deep inside, and it cuts like a knife. She's out of my life.
I'll do the verses, then I'll do the choruses. One, two, three, four.
I mean, I can't sit here and tell you that Quincy Jones wasn't or isn't a brilliant arranger, or that Rod Temperton didn't know how to write a hit song, or that Rodney Jerkins or Dark Child or Teddy Riley couldn't make a track jam. But listen to the demo for Beat It. Every track is Michael. And then tell me who the genius was in that room.
Show them how funk is strong, it's your fight. It doesn't matter who's wrong or right. Just beat it, beat it, beat it, beat it.
No, that's my outshot.
Beat it, beat it. Show them how funk is strong, it's your fight. It doesn't matter who's...
That's all for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where a kind listener just sent us a record album. It's by Monk Higgins. It's called MacArthur Park. I guess he probably plays the song MacArthur Park, but he is a saxophonist, and there is a gorgeous picture of him in a bright blue suit on a bright blue boat playing the saxophone in the middle of MacArthur Park Lake. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He's the one who put that record on a chair sitting directly across from me. He had help from Casey O'Brien. Production fellows at MaximumFun.org are Jesus Ambrosio and Shayna Deloria. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Our interstitial music was recorded by DJW, a.k.a. Dan Wally. Our thanks to him for sharing it with us. Our theme song is a tune by the Go Team called Huddle Formation. Our thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries Records for letting us use it. I know I say that every week, but I'm genuinely very grateful to the Go Team, who personally approved that because I love that song. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, all of them are free at MaximumFun.org. We're also on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube. You can find all the interviews and segments from this week's show on YouTube if you type in Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can find them on Facebook, like us there, etc., etc. And I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.